Good morning, everybody, and I'm sorry, talking about DevOps or artificial intelligence in French is something I just cannot do. It's an interesting topic and really is changing sort of fairly dramatically. And so let me first frame the sort of view of why we're doing this. And it really starts off with, if you're going to reimagine the world, and if you're going to reimagine the world to be digital, what would that look like? So is reimagining the world today and not being digital is kind of a strange thing. And we continually talk about transformation of the business and businesses being digital. But what we've never done is talked about what we do from an IT perspective and how we digitize ourselves. And if you actually think about all the business intelligence systems that we build today, they're business intelligence systems for the business. They're about sales. They're about marketing. They're about inventory. But we really don't do anything about business intelligence for developers and business intelligence for IT. And we live in this very data-rich world with data flowing all over the place. But as developers, we tend to think primarily about number of bugs and number of fixes and number of releases. But that's sort of basic data. There is so much more data that we can get that you can use to really help define what you do, when you do it, how well you do it. And so, to a large degree, what's made DevOps as a method, technique, culture possible has been data, just lots of data. And if you start to collect data, data about your users, data about availability, data about things that go right, data about things that go wrong, as soon as you start to collect that data, you can actually start to make decisions in real time. And so we've talked about real-time business and managing real-time inventory and managing real-time sales and managing real-time revenue. And all that DevOps is actually about is managing real-time software. It sounds fairly simple, but culturally is a massive change. It's a change for developers. It's a change for people who are in operations. It's a change for the people who use your systems because they have a different expectation of the kinds of things that are going to happen. And so I've sort of framed this broadly, but I'll sort of walk around a little bit on the introduction to sort of frame it from sort of the sort of customer perspective. And so the digital transformation is actually couched in sort of many key terms. The first one really comes from Satya, which talks about every company as a software company. And I can tell you I travel the world all the time, and I probably travel 3 or 4 weeks a month all over the world, and I talk to many large customers and small customers, and this is a consistent theme. There are companies that used to make parts and components out of metal and steel and rubber, and suddenly they're realizing that they're actually a software company. And you're seeing this happen at an incredible rate in the car industry today, where cars to a large degree haven't really changed for 100 years. They're about metal and rubber, and a little bit of engine, a little bit of gasoline, and you actually can go quick. That hasn't really changed since car started, a fundamental view. And then Tesla happened. And Tesla happens to be a whole lot of computers connected by a network on the car, remotely on the car, that happen to communicate at high speed, that happen to transport people around. And suddenly you've got a transformation of that business where the car business is actually becoming a software business. And if we had talked to you about upgrading your car 10 years ago, that would have been taking your car to a dealer and painting it blue instead of red. And you would leave it for a couple days and you'd come back, or you'd put a turbocharger on your engine and that would take a week. And today, updating your car is actually getting a firmware download overnight and just installing the firmware. And so the rate of change of the business is going on, but you're still left with the same scenario where car companies are software companies, companies that make large electric motors or software companies. We've been doing some interesting IoT work with some of the big vendors of big industrial motors, 500 horsepower motors, 1,000 horsepower motors, which is probably the size of this room. They're used in big mines and things. And the question is, what sort of feedback does the designer get about that electric motor? How much does he know about that motor? And what are the things that you could measure? You could measure current, you could measure voltage, you could measure speed. And so we were out talking to some of the users, and one of the old maintenance guys in this mine said, all that stuff is actually nonsense. The thing you want to look at with a motor is put a microphone onto it and listen to the motor sing. Because when something's going wrong, the voice of that motor changes. When it's turning and the way the sound comes out is different. So if you want to listen to that motor and see what's going to happen and be predictive of failure and run a machine learning system, just listen to it operating. And you can actually tell from the voice of the motor what actually is going on. And so here you've got companies that have been making electric motors for hundreds of years suddenly realizing that they too are a software company. The second thing that's happening is that the speed of business is changing. It's unclear whether companies that are software companies because business is changing or businesses changing because companies are software companies. It's unclear which one comes first. But what we do know is that the rate of business is changing, the rate of decision making is changing, which means that the rate of systems that run inside of those companies has to change. The systems that are e-commerce systems or chat systems or bot systems or management systems or logistics systems or retail systems, suddenly they have to change. You know, if you talk to many telcos, telecommunication companies, they're continually creating new programs on your mobile account. You can have two phones and you can get a gigabyte of data and you can get free SMS messages and you can get this. And those marketing programs are changing constantly depending on the conditions of the marketplace. And what generally slows them down is the billing system that actually knows how to bill and knows how to count a gigabyte of data or 10 gigabyte of data and how much they should charge you for that. And so generally it's been the systems that have slowed us down. There's been some very good work that was done, kind of readable, by a group at MIT that looks at really the impact of technology on business and business on technology. And they've gone out and interviewed, I think this is 500 companies that are going through a digital transformation. And they've put those companies into four quadrants. And then they've also looked at financial measures of those companies. In other words, is the revenue of the company changing? The profitability, because your revenue could go up, but you could be less profitable. And then also the market cap is the perceived value of the company. So in this chart, the bottom corner over here, the people who are actually the beginners about digitization, they're actually learning. But what we see is that their revenue is dropping, their profitability, revenue is dropping 4%, profitability is dropping 11%. So they're less profitable, less revenue, market cap is dropping. What they call the fashionistas, who are people who are trying random digital experiments without really understanding the impact, their revenue is going up, but as you see, their profitability is kind of staying the same, and actually their market value is dropping. Remember, this is about 500 companies around the world. The conservatives, which would have not been my inclination for a company to become digital, was go and experiment and then decide what you're going to do. But what they've actually found is the conservatives, who are actually very cautious about what they do, they've transformed their management systems before they've actually transferred with a high digital intensity. So they're actually backing up what they do with management commitment. Suddenly, their revenues are dropping because of their experimenting, but guess what? They're 10% profitable, more profitable. So between, if you actually look at the fashionistas in there, you get an 11% drop here and a 9% increase. There's a 20% difference in profitability of companies that instead of randomly experimenting and failing early, these are companies that have management commitment to transforming the company digitally. And at the top are the guys who know what they're doing, the digitalizers who are actually all over the place, and you can see their numbers are actually quite amazing. Profitability is up 26%. So if you actually look at, we're losing 11 and up 26, you're almost 40% more profitable if you actually do this in a coordinated way, which means you actually do things digital, but you actually have the infrastructure and governance and management commitment behind it. And the reason that I included this slide was that the same theory actually applies to DevOps, because it actually takes massive commitment. It takes commitment from the developers, it takes commitment from managers, it takes commitment from the business that you're giving that to, it takes commitment from your customers that they give you the kinds of feedback that you're looking for. And if you don't have that, and you just say, we used to be agile, we're gonna go to DevOps, you're actually sitting in this bucket up here, which means that it may or may not work, but there's lots of problems over here. And so the notion is, you need to have the infrastructure in place, the business governance in place, in order to be successful. Forrester, in a similar way, actually has done some analysis, and the question that they ask here was what are the positive business impacts from your company that you would expect to get faster, accurate delivery of applications? And there really are two things. We think we're going to increase our revenue, and we think we're going to increase user satisfaction if you actually move to a shorter cycle. Those are the sort of two things that come out of it. So those are good goals. Actually make more money and make people happy. Those are all good goals, but how do you actually do it? IDC, it's interesting, all these people look at the same problem in very different ways. They actually look at a different question, which is around the ability of the companies. You actually see the digital transformation of the company. There's a big gap over here between without a DevOps and with a DevOps, and this is the ability of the company to actually speed up their business. The ability of companies to change their business processes in terms of the business by having systems that are delivered without DevOps and with DevOps. And there's a big gap there as well. So there's lots of good business reason to do it, and there's lots of good business constraints to do it, which means you need to do it with the right governance and the right way and the right people. So the perspective on this is that if you're going to innovate and transform, those things have to happen at the same time. You're going to innovate and transform in the business, but if you're going to innovate and transform in the way you build systems, the same thing applies. A little bit about sort of customer partnership, which is generally when we build systems, we sort of build them in this way, which is we ask the when, what, and who, and build a specification about that. But it actually turns out we've become experts at asking the wrong questions, because the question we're not asking is why. In many cases, we're not going out to the users and saying, well, why exactly did you want this? And what are you going to do with it? And what is the hypothesis that the customer is asking for this thing? What is the experiment that you use to solve the hypothesis? And have you actually agreed with the hypothesis or not once you've actually done the experiment? And so you, in many cases, when you do this, one of the core changes is instead of reading a spec and actually replicating exactly what the spec says, you actually have to change some of the questions and talk a little bit more about why. And being able to talk to a user then, you actually have to be able to talk to real users. And you can talk to those users either in a conversation or you can talk to them through telemetry. And it turns out that telemetry is going to become the tool that all of us are going to use. A little more framing about transformation is when, I need to step back a bit. As you start to ask why, one of the things that you discover is, and I apologize for the English here, is what's called the adjacent possible. In other words, as you start to ask why with somebody, you actually identify something that is close to it, but different. And this is actually a Heisenberg physics problem, which is that as you start to investigate that possible space, it expands. And it expands in an interesting way where people tell you things that you weren't expecting. The possibilities start opening up dramatically. And what happens is you start to identify this shadow of the future. And the job as you develop these systems and as you sort of gyrate through the DevOps is to find that shadow future and actually bring it forward. Bring it forward through telemetry, bring it forward through understanding, bring it forward through failure. So you can actually develop for people what they're asking for and really what they want rather than what you think they want. And so the underlying part of it is really understand the environment. So let me put that now into a DevOps context. And the way I'll frame this is the journey that we went through as we did this. What did Microsoft go through as we switched from the sort of path that we were on, which was generally a 2 to 3 year development cycle. You got a release of Windows, you got a couple of updates along the way, and then you got another big release of Windows, or Office, or Bing for that matter. And so there's some really interesting insights that came from the Bing team. The Bing system actually runs, depending on where it is, about 100,000 servers. It actually runs across multiple data centers, and it's more like an organic amoeba that sort of grows and shrinks in real time as a single large system. I'm not sure that you actually can stop it even. And there are lots of people experimenting at it in real time. In other words, if somebody has an idea, a hypothesis that they'd like to try, we can actually experiment with that in real time and say, we want 5% of the users in Paris to see this and 10% of the users in Frankfurt to see this. And then we're going to compare the results and we'll have answers tomorrow morning. So the rate of experimentation and understanding really is just accelerated beyond anything that you've seen. But one of the great observations that came back from the Bing team was 100% passing of a test is 100% impossible. You never get to that situation in real time, and how do you actually deal with the ability to test and understand, because there's always scenarios that arise that you don't know about. I like this one here. These are all actually quotes from people deep in the Bing system. Craig Miller is one of the technical advisors on Bing, and he actually has this second quote, which it's not about getting code to production, it's about getting ideas into production. And we tend to have thought, well, oh, idea equals an implementation of a spec that actually is an implementation and a version of a code and an object library. And if I can get that object library in, I've actually delivered the result. And you actually sometimes forget really about what people are trying to do. We wrote this paper a while ago, which is why does large software projects fail? Part of my job in Microsoft services around the world is actually technical quality assurance. And I'm always fascinated by why big projects work and why some big projects fail. And one of the scenarios that come out of it is actually bad specifications. The specifications are complete. They're actually very detailed. You know, it's an RFP that has section 1.7.9.2 that says this screen must be 3 pixels. So they're very detailed in some cases, but in some cases they're not detailed enough to actually understand the use cases, to actually understand the real scenario, the real testing. And in many cases, we test with fraudulent data. We test with data that people have given you as test data that's not real. And in a waterfall approach, you actually took the test data, you ran the test data, you built your code to run the test data, and then you put it in production and it fails because the real world doesn't look like your test data. And so we actually, there's several parts of this, which is understanding the requirements, understanding the scenario sufficiently to have a data set that's meaningful. But probably the biggest lesson is the real test you do is when you go into production and you start to see real people use it. And when we start to measure systems, the ability of systems to be accurate when they go live, particularly on a waterfall project that's run for 3 years, is pretty tough. And we actually have got some great data that shows how many systems fail in the first week. That's what we call an alpha test. Is we're going to put the system out there in alpha test and we're sure it's going to fail, but we're not going to call it production until we've seen some more. And so doing an alpha and a beta test is actually a very early primitive version of Agile, except it's in a 3-year cycle. The sort of what is DevOps and what it's not, there's lots of people who think it's these things. It's, you know, operations and development collaborating. That's actually not true. It's about a job title, it's about automation, it's about faster, smaller builds. Well, that's starting to get close. But I'll tell you one of the things that we did, Microsoft Engineering. Prior to this, we had a very clear set of job titles. We have a job title called Program Manager, who somebody writes specs. We had somebody who was called a Software Developer, an SDE, a Software Development Engineer, who's somebody who writes code. We had somebody who's a tester. Software development, SDET, engineering, tester, and then some other roles around that, around user education and documentation. Those are the roles that we had. And as you can imagine, program manager spec, developers write code, testers test. Testers throw things over the wall back to a developer, maybe a different developer. They redevelop, give it to a different tester. They test, fails, throw it back over. And go through that loop. And we were actually pretty sophisticated about this. We knew the ratio of developers and testers when you start, the ratio of developers and testers when you finished. We land up automating a lot of testing. There are actually bots that run most of the testing that we've got. In the case of Windows, which is a very large system, imagine the size of the Windows project is huge. You know, many hundreds of millions of lines of code. That gets built at least once a day. A series of automatic tests run, and the person who breaks the build gets a little thing hung on their door, which is you're the goat of the build, and you need to fix your problem because you're holding everybody up. We've actually exposed that to people now. If you're on some of the fast branches of the insider, you're actually seeing daily builds or weekly builds in some cases, and you're seeing sort of some cases they work, some cases there's bugs, but you're actually seeing what it takes to do that daily. The change that we developed when we actually went to sort of operating in a different way, we don't have any testers anymore. There is nobody inside of Microsoft who has the job title of tester. It's gone. We actually only have people who are engineers. They write specs, they develop, they test, they put into operations, they carry a phone, so when something goes wrong at 3 o'clock in the morning, their telephone rings, That's an amazing way to change people's behaviors. The first time your phone rings at 3 o'clock in the morning because your code broke something is the last time it'll happen. But like I said, no testers. There is nobody in Microsoft today has a job title of tester. So if you're going to make these changes, you actually have to commit to making the changes. If you're actually going to go into DevOps and you really are going to develop, engineer, test, and deploy in real time, you can't have anybody else who's a tester because it's going to take more than a day for one person to hand it to the next. What it also means, if you've actually followed quality theory, total quality management, TQM as it's called, from Dr. Deming and the sort of Toyota way, nothing like being responsible for your own quality. If you're responsible for your own quality, it changes. And so for many years, large engineering, software engineering projects, we actually didn't do that. We actually made somebody else accountable for quality. And one of the most interesting thing of DevOps is we're all responsible for quality in one way or another. And that's a massive cultural change. And the cultural change in our case comes from the top, the engineering management, the executive VPs who run Windows, who run Office, who run Bing. They actually support this. And so we just don't have anybody with that title anymore, because that's the easiest way of not having testers, is not have testers. So we sort of went there. The sort of canonical view of DevOps is you go from dev to operations, and you go from operations back to development. The thing that's happening, though, is that it's spinning here at an incredible rate. So it's not only the same people, but it's the speed. And so one of the questions that I get is, how often do you deploy? And went back to the Visual Studio team. I've got some data about Visual Studio Online and their experience. They deploy about 100 times a day, which means you have to have very efficient deployment tools. If your deployment is all automated and you've got 20 or 30 developers in a sprint, you're deploying in real time all the time. What that means is that you have to do some other things, which is that you have to deploy some functions with a flag that says, deploy it, but don't put it into production. And then I'm going to change some metadata in real time to switch functionality on and off. Previously, the switch on and off was install bits on a disk and, you know, a new DLL for your actual code. DevOps said, no, you actually deploy and you can switch things on and off in real time in the code through metadata. It actually becomes a sort of operations thing about enabling and disabling, or enabling for a certain group of people and not others. The example that I said of, let's test something and try 10% of the people accessing some function from Paris versus 5% accessing it from Frankfurt. Those are all metadata switches that you actually incorporate into your code to enable and disable functionality, enable and disable versioning in real time. So in some cases, as I said, we deploy, you know, potentially 100 times a day. There's code being deployed with your, so your deployment engines have to be incredibly, incredibly efficient in how you do that. So let's think about some of the transformation. Again, before I get into the details, there's some core understanding, which is this. Telemetry is your friend. Actually, it's not only your friend, it's your brother, your sister, your mother, every piece of family that you've got. We have to build telemetry deeply into the system. So think about an application that you write in the cloud. You've written a VB.NET application. It runs on-premise on a server and a couple of clients, a little database, and you move it to the cloud. When it was running on-prem and something went wrong, you'd actually stop the server, say, just hang on a minute, I need to load a kernel debugger. Go back to Visual Studio, load a kernel debugger, start to debug it. You've got three users, so it doesn't really matter. You just go talk to them and say, just hang on, I need to fix this thing. You actually go in, run a debug, run some test scenarios. You ask some of the end users to test it, and you say, great, I fixed it, and you go back into production. So now you're in the cloud, and you're running multiple instances of the application. It's running in 5 or 6 data centers around the world. You've got 1 million people accessing it in real time, and you discover a bug. You can't really do what you did before. You can't say, hey, can you just stop Azure for a minute? I just need to load a kernel debugger over here. All those millions of people, just hang on. I'm busy. Let me go fix this bug, and I'll be back in a minute. That doesn't work. And so the real thing about telemetry is building communication capability, business intelligence into your application. And the way to think about it was, as the developer, as the operator of an application, if your application could talk to you, not to the customer, if it could talk to you, if you could actually have a conversation with your application while it's running, much as when you go to the doctor and the doctor puts something onto your lungs and says, how does it feel? Cough. when you talk to your application, how would you say to your application, how do you feel? Do you feel busy? Do you see a denial of service attack? What's your performance like? What's the latency? What are the questions you would ask your application? And that's essentially what telemetry gives you, is the ability to get data back about the health and welfare of your application. In many ways, it's actually might be performance data, it might be functional information, it might be who's using what kind of device to access this, how many Android phones are there, how many Windows phones, how many pads, where are they coming from, what's the geography that they're coming from. Those are all good questions that you need to be able to get access to. And imagine you're sitting in a room and you're talking to your application. You say, so tell me, where are your users? How fast are they? Are the people in London seeing better performance than the people in Hong Kong? Those are the kinds of questions you need to ask. And so we've done some work in the Visual Studio team that looks at this problem in a different way. This work actually started off as a debug tool for the cloud. It was actually designed for developers, but it quickly became a tool for DevOps. The tool's called Application Insights. And the way Application Insights works is on any application. It could be a .NET application running on-premise. It could be a Linux application running. It could be an application running in the cloud. There's three ways of deploying it. The first one is you drop an agent onto the server, and the agent starts to collect basic server-based information. The second one is you can bind the agent into your application. You'll start to get richer data back. And the third one is your application can actually call the telemetry agent and send back unique data for your application. What happens is that data is actually sent to Azure. It can be sent along an encrypted channel, goes into a blob data store in Azure, and then you can start to browse data. We put Power BI on top of it, and now you're looking at business intelligence for your app. And you're having a conversation with the application, and it's telling you things about the application. But if you have a running .NET application today, go get your test system. You don't have to do it in production if you want to learn. Get your test system, drop the agent in. If it's on-premise, just open up a port to Azure. If it's in Azure, you're actually done. And start to see what can happen. That takes about an hour just to do that. So imagine what you can do in an hour. Let me show you some screenshots about what you get back. You probably know one of the big projects we've done is with Real Madrid, the football team, or Real Madrid if you're in Spain. And that application goes to a target of 400 million users around the world. It has days where there are peaks and not peaks. When Real Madrid's playing Barcelona, it's pretty busy. When they're playing some other teams, maybe not. Real Madrid's now in the UEFA Cup final, so maybe it'll be a little more busy. So we start to see some interesting information about basic things like geography. And so this is Power BI built on top of the telemetry store. By the way, this is for free. You don't have to do anything to do this to get this Power BI. So the first one is a heat map. And it's the heat map of where users are spending time. So you can see here, most people are in the start screen. There's a block over here called the virtual ticket. The virtual ticket is where people go in and look at video on demand. You go look at the goal that Ronaldo scored last week. This is static in this picture, but when you watch this, it's actually live. And so you can actually see when Real Madrid is playing Barcelona, most people are spending in the virtual ticket because they're looking at replays. So in real time, you can see where users are spending their time. You actually see these blocks move because you're getting that data back in real time in the window. How would you have done this before? How would you actually got information back about where users are spending their time in your application? The only way that you would have done it before is actually videotaping a user. Actually standing there with a camera and videotaping a user and watch what they do. What's amazing about touch-based systems is people can touch anywhere. And they do. They touch anywhere. And an interesting way, if your application is expecting a user to touch in one place on the screen and they touch in another place, what are you going to do about it? Do you even know about it? Or does the user goes in and says, well, this didn't work, and they go off and do something else? How do you actually find out when the users are doing things that you're not expecting? So the first thing you get is these diagrams. You can actually look at, in this case, who's in what language. It's primarily Spanish and English. You get these very interesting demographic maps, which actually show you where the users are. And if you click into this, you can see how many people are using an Android phone in the middle of Africa versus in Australia. You can actually, and that comes for free. The device type actually comes for free, which is pretty important when you're building an application that has to go to multiple device types. So you get that sort of information back. You can actually look at different kind of views in Power BI. If you don't know what Power BI is, you need to learn it. You can actually start to drill down a little bit further. So you can actually look at active people at any time. You can actually see there are peaks when there are games on. During the week, it's a little slow, but you get a peak depending on the games on a Tuesday or a Saturday. You get monthly churn on users. At this point in time, there were actually 1.7 million people online. So you get these real numbers back, and that number sort of ticks over. You can create a timeline for a user. You can actually create a timeline of the calls, the actual timeline of every call that a individual user makes. So if your user can't do something and they call up your help desk and they said, it doesn't work, you can actually go back and replay what they did. You can actually go look at the series of calls, of web service calls. You can actually see the performance on the calls. In other words, you can see yesterday a particular service call that went out of the system onto the internet, making a call somewhere else, took 140 milliseconds yesterday, but takes 500 milliseconds today. So you can actually see where the time issues are. And you actually can go back and say, why is today different to yesterday? What has changed between yesterday and today? Is it just high latency in the internet? Or is the other guy slow? There's a whole bunch of things you can do. And so when I talked about business intelligence for IT, this is what I'm talking about, deep understanding of your application and what it does. Because the story behind this is if you're going to switch to DevOps, you can't do it without this. You have to understand what is going on in real time and how to interact. And so I've got a series of slides here that I'm going to walk through that comes from the Visual Studio team. I'm sure most of you or all of you use Visual Studio in one way or another. And the Visual Studio team went from Visual Studio to Team Foundation Server. Team Foundation Server went online as to what's now called Visual Studio Online, and actually then went, they actually went from Agile to DevOps. And Sam Guckenheimer, who's one of the technical fellows in that group, wrote a series of papers that talked about that particular journey and some of the things that they learned. And so I thought the best thing to do for you is actually tell you what we learned and how we learned it and what we've done. And it's sort of an interesting view about the way we think about DevOps and some of the things we did right and a whole lot of things that we did wrong. So this is actually the Visual Studio team saying what it took for them to become a software as a service vendor. Prior to this, you saw Visual Studio release every couple of years. Maybe there was a new editor, some new functionality that went into Team Foundation Server. There were add-ins that came periodically during that period, but it really was a waterfall. And then when they went to Visual Studio Online and actually went into DevOps, suddenly they learned a whole bunch of things in these categories. And I'll sort of move through them in a different way. So the first one is about team autonomy. It talks about having small teams. Teams can be up to 25, but sometimes smaller, sometimes bigger. We changed the rooms that they work in. So you can't say, I want everybody to be DevOps, but everybody's going to have their own office in different buildings. So the first thing we did is we actually changed the furniture. We took down the walls, and everybody in a particular team, a unit, sits in a big room that looks like this. And if you have a question, you kind of lean over and ask the other guy. And everybody is there in that room 24 hours a day. As it turns out, there's somebody there. Actually having a much closer conversation. And the previous separation between development and test or spec writers and user education people is now gone. Everybody's in the same room together, and everybody's a peer inside of this team. What's interesting is that various team leads appear at different times. In the early stages, it's actually generally led by people specifying. In the later stages, it's actually led by engineering, and there's a cycle that you actually land up going through. So though it sounds simple, one of the first things you want to do is change the furniture. It sounds crazy, but if you don't actually do this, we've discovered one of the things you're going to struggle. They actually went to 3-week sprints, which is pretty common, but overlapping sprints. And even inside of every sprint, they're actually deploying every day. And by the way, they have multiple parallel sprint teams. So there are actually multiple teams working on sprints at the same time, all pushing code into the production system. You have to find a way of actually carving and separating functionality and trying to make sure that you don't have overlaps. Together with the sprints, they actually went to a planning horizon. And there's multiple planning horizons. There's 3-week sprints, what they called a chat, which is that every 9 weeks they would get together and actually try and focus on what it is they're going to do in that sort of next quarter. A season was every 6 months, and then a vision every 18 months. Given the rate of change and the speed of change, the speed of requirements change, it starts to become pretty important to understand your ability to respond, because there's some things that you actually respond to quickly, but you still have to have this vision of where you want to get to. What's interesting is the vision may or may not change. We try and keep to that. We try and actually keep to that 18th month vision and be clear about the point that we're trying to get to. What's interesting is the path that you take to get from now to the vision actually changes. And it's definitely not linear. It looks more like Brownian motion, where you actually have some non-linear things because you discover some new feedback, you discover some new things you want to do, you stop doing some other things. So generally, you actually get to the vision, but it's not necessarily on the traversal that you thought you were going to take. And that's actually okay, because you have to have people, everybody needs to be aligned to the place that you're trying to get to. The second thing is about managing what's called managing technical debt. Technical debt is things that you owe, which generally is bugs and fixes. And how do you manage that backlog of things? And you have to think about this like a bank account. Every day that you leave some debt in the bank, it draws interest from you. It draws energy from you. It draws people from you. And so one of the big things about trying to understand the debt, it's a little bit like when you get a mortgage on your house, is how are you going to pay that debt off as quickly as you can, and trying to make the decisions of prioritization on the debt. And every day that you leave something is a day that it gets worse. That's kind of the way of thinking about sort of the technical debt. And so there's some ways that we sort of talk about how to deal with this. And there's a philosophical question, which is stay clean and move fast. Those two things have to go together, because sometimes things get dirty, and the first requirement is to go wash your hands and get clean and clean up all the debt behind you, and then sort of move quickly. So ship quickly with minimum friction. I'm not sure if you can see this, but dream of a system that can do hands-free push of hot fixes into production in 15 minutes. That's what they would like to do. We're not quite there yet. But how do you get a hot fix out to a system? I can tell you, in the case of old Windows or Office, getting a hot fix out was a pretty interesting experience. It wasn't that hot, it was actually lukewarm. And the question is how, in your systems as you build them, when something goes wrong and you discover potentially a security flaw, how quickly can you fix it? Can you actually fix it in 15 minutes? Because then sometimes those are the things you've got to do, because you might have to switch the system off rather than fix it. So how quickly can you respond? A fast and predictable inner loop, which means the loop of build, deploy, test, build, deploy, test, build, deploy, test, runs several hundred times a day, which means that your testing, most of your testing has to be highly automated. The build and deployment has to be highly automated. How you actually migrate as an individual developer things into that deployment test cycle needs to happen quickly. Because if you're actually only building once a week, that's not very agile. Because if you discover something's wrong, you're actually going to take you another week to get it into the system. And so DevOps is actually this notion of actually speed, speed of people, speed of thought, speed of action to be able to respond, which means that the underlying infrastructure has to be able to move at that same kind of speed. And then the sort of the quality approach is designed for the cloud cadence, which is build confidence through staging of data, exposure control, and telemetry. And so really one of the core underlying pieces of this is telemetry. You can decide if you want to use Application Insights or not. It's actually an amazing tool. If you want to build your own telemetry, party on and go do it. But you need something. You actually need to be able to get that data back. Testing and how you test, the granularity of tests, the lowest level of test, the integration test. There was a time when, the big integration test was you tested everything together the week before you went into production. That was the first time that you actually tested interaction of systems. It's the first time you tested individual subsystems and how they interact with one another. And you discovered all sorts of things, or in fact, you missed a whole series of things as well. And so this notion of testability and integrated testability is every test is an integrated test. It's always an integrated test. You always need to have a look at both the effects and the side effects of what you're doing in different ways. There's then a question of flow of function and flow of customer value. are you measuring it and do you understand it? And actually, are you looking at what users are doing? So matching the service level to the customer experience. It's an interesting question in many cases when I ask, you know, architects, for example, on a big application, what do you think your service level is? And generally, I get some number of nines, 3 nines, 5 nines, 2 nines. That's what people think service level is. And it's sometimes interesting to ask your customer what they think service level is, because it actually might be different. And so one of the things that we've done over this is sort of this outside-in synthetic transaction, which was imagine what a user is doing, and at all times, test that scenario. Don't test what you think, but test what the user's thinking. Insist on health, failed or slow user response per account. In other words, go into your telemetry and actually look at what individual users are doing. One of the most interesting things are what I'll call abandonment, which is somebody tries to do something, can't do it, and they leave. And you don't know why they left. And so the knowledge of abandonment is incredibly valuable. And we actually never used to track that. We only used to track when things went wrong or people did things right. But we never looked for things where people didn't do anything. They went in and just left. Which if you're on a smartphone in an application, it's so easy to do. I'm trying to do something. I touched the wrong screen. Well, I just back out and start again. People do that all the time. And so trying to understand what the users are doing, again, via the telemetry, and actually looking at an individual user starts to get fascinating. This is actually also a philosophical change, which instead of focusing on everybody doing it right, focus on the people doing it wrong. So focus on the outliers. Try and understand who the people on the outliers are. Actually, go and find them. Go find them by name if you can and talk to them. Because it turns out when you solve the outlier problem, you actually solve a lot of other people's problems because they're doing something different. And the question is, why are they doing things different than what you expected? So in many cases, we've actually looked at the outliers and said, well, it's in the 0.5%, so I don't care. But it turns out if you solve the 0.5%, you actually solve the other 99% in many cases. And so go find the outliers by name. Find out either outliers by people, by group, by country. If you see a set of behaviors that looks weird, go and find out why. And again, the basic, you know, when I showed you the telemetry pieces about being able to find people by geography or by function, you now get a sense of what it is you want to do that and how you want to do that. We actually track customers. We've actually deleted the names over here, so you actually can't see the names, but these are actually individual people. There are people in the team who actually become the champion for either that individual or that group of people. They know who they are. They communicate to them. They actually talk to them, which is a funny thing for a developer. You need to talk to people. You need to go out and talk to people and ask them, what do they like? What do they don't like? And actually, it's an interesting thing. When you ask people, they will tell you things. And so we actually systematize that. We monitor it. The data all gets entered. And we actually start to look at these graphs and look at behaviors and have individuals on the team. Everybody on the team is responsible for somebody's health. And we therefore need to know what's wrong with that particular user and why do they think this, and really start to look at the core edge cases. Go look at that backlog. Planning what's next. Is the backlog a series of specifications of what's next? Or what does the backlog actually represent? Is the backlog just a bunch of functions you're never going to implement that are always on the backlog? Which means they shouldn't be on the backlog. You should just get rid of them. So how do you actually think about the backlog? And so there's this fairly simple methodology which talks about develop a hypothesis based on the backlog, have an experiment, learn does the experiment prove the hypothesis or not, recycle and go back to the beginning. And so when you start to look at it, go through this simple method, which is we believe, you know, in a simple sort of text form here, parsable, we believe that a group of customers want some set of features because, and there's some value proposition. This little part turns out to be the hardest part, which is the why. Why is it that you want this? So earlier on, I talked about asking why. This is the what, the who, but not necessarily the why. And so you need to know why, because you need to know the value. Because if you actually know the value of something to somebody, if some things are more valuable than others, maybe you should actually change the order that you develop them on. Maybe you don't because there's a prerequisite of architecture that you need to get into the system. But you should always ask yourself, are you actually addressing the high-value things? And in order to do that, you need to have this little parsable clause set up that says, What is it you want? Who wants it? And why do they want it? And that'll actually help you sort through your backlog. Otherwise, we actually don't. Sometimes we actually just look at backlog as priority. This is priority one, priority two, priority three. And it's very interesting when you ask people, why is this one a priority one? And typically the answer is because there's a very noisy user who actually insists we do it. Why? Well, we're not sure why, but they're just really noisy and we need to solve it quickly. You need to understand the experiment, which is how do you prove the value? The experiment is actually trying something out and proving the value, and then recycle and come back out again. And so here's just an interesting example. This was setting up a new project in Visual Studio Online, where the initial intent was to cram as much as we could on one screen so that nobody had to go through screens. And it turned out, when we actually looked at the telemetry, nobody knew how to do it. And we actually went to an after where we both the web and the online side are the same, where there was actually this sort of wizard-level approach of actually a new user coming in, and the goal of a new user coming in the system is how quickly can they spawn a new project. Do they actually do something when they come in, or do they just kind of wander around and take a look and not do anything? And so we ran a bunch of measurements, and these measurements are number of accounts creating project on the day of account creation. So when you created an account, did you create a new project? And what we found before we went that change, in other words, this is the one screen does everything, by day, you can actually see the percentage of people. It's typically, there's a good day over here because this is when the system launched, a big launch. But after that, it's kind of sitting at about 15%. Started a new project the day they created an account. When we actually simplified the user experience, which is a hard thing to do, and actually went to the sort of agent view, suddenly the world changed. Suddenly we went from 15% to more like 30%. We doubled the number of times that somebody got a new account and added a new project. We must have done something right when we did that. But how do you know? You know because you actually measured it. You set a criteria which said, the goal of changing this user experience is we want people to be able to get into a project quickly and start doing real stuff and not get lost in trying to figure out how to set up an account and do you have your credit card and what's your phone number and other things like that. And so you start to see very different things. This one over here is the number of accounts creating projects on the day the account a little bit later, which is actually the IDE. This is just the IDE side. This is the website. On the IDE, because again, we're getting telemetry back from the IDE, it's like 2%, and it goes up to 20% on the IDE as opposed to the website. So the hypothesis was we need more people to be able to get into the system and get a project in quickly. In order to do that, the hypothesis was the current experience is too complicated and people are getting lost. How do we actually simplify the experience? We found out we could simplify it through this multi-screen thing, and here's the proof. And so this is a very nice example because good things happen, but good things don't always happen. Sometimes the experiment fails and you see bad things, but seeing bad things is actually just as good as seeing good things because you can actually go and fix it. So know what you're going to measure, measure it, start off with the control, do the experiment, and make a decision. And then finally, this is about evidence gathered in production. This is the telemetry piece. On Visual Studio Online, they collect everything. Incredible amounts of data. They generally collect about 60 gigabytes a day. That actually adds up pretty quickly over a week, even more over a year. And then they have people who actually are data scientists who wander through that data and actually start to look at it incredibly intensely. Not only user data, but sort of dashboard, DevOps data, basic telemetry coming out of the applications, the various experiments, do everything. There are these time-level traces that we look at. We look at operational intelligence. We look at customer intelligence. This is a data-rich environment, and that's one of the things that enable DevOps is the ability to do that. We define some pretty important metrics about availability. Some perf counters. This is a dashboard that people look at every day. These dashboards are on big monitors and people can actually see them. The ping mesh, which is if you actually have a complex application that actually runs across multiple nodes, either inside of your network or even across your network, what does that ping mesh look like? Are you actually seeing high latency points somewhere in that mesh? Today, you don't know the answer to that. The only time you know an answer to that is when the user in Australia says, like, it's slow, and you actually don't know why, and why it used to be fast yesterday and why it's slow today. And so the ability to actually have this mesh, which means you have to have a model of the topology of the application, not in your head, but actually specified somewhere. Let me tell you a quick story about Olympic websites. We've been doing the websites for Olympics since London, a little bit earlier than that, some at the Commonwealth Games. The website for the London Olympics was cloned for the Sochi Olympics, and it's the same architecture that's being used for the Rio Olympics. You go to the website, it's rio2016.com, which, funnily enough, actually derives about 10 years ago from one of the very first early large websites, which was the Harry Potter website called Pottermore, which when launched was actually a crazy site. There's a fundamental philosophy in building that system, which is when you actually ask architects about how they build highly scalable systems, you actually get into a debate of how many nines again. Was this architected for 3 nines, for 5 nines, for 10 nines? It's an interesting debate about how many nines you're going to design your application. The interesting thing about an Olympic website, or in fact Harry Potter for that matter, is the answer is no nines. The answer is 100% availability all the time for a period of time. And so how can you design an application to actually have 100% perceived availability? Actually, it's fairly simple. We have this wonderful thing called the cloud. And in the cloud, we have multiple data centers. And so in the case of the Sochi Winter Olympics, the application actually ran in 4 data centers, one in the US, 2 in Europe, and 1 in Asia. And in each one of those data centers, there were 2 instances running. So there were actually 8 instances of the application running. We actually built it out and we tested it to 300,000 hits per second. The maximum we got in the Winter Olympics was 110,000, which was during the ice hockey final, to be predictable. What was interesting about the ice hockey final is that in the end it was between Canada and Sweden. So we saw very high demand in Canada and Sweden. Nobody else actually cared. And so how you build out the system, it's pretty interesting because you know in a hockey final, there's going to be 2 teams by definition. You know in the semifinal, there's going to be 4 teams. But you actually don't know where they are. You don't know where the load is going to come from. You know, it could have been Finland and the United States in the hockey final. Turned out to be Canada and Sweden. And so trying to understand and be predictable of where load is one of the interesting things you have to do. But in this case, it didn't matter because no matter where you were in the world and coming through the CDN, you either went to the service that was closest to you, or if that was unavailable for some reason, you actually got pinged to the next available service and you noticed a slight change of latency, but it was still 100% available. Maybe just a touch slower, but maybe you didn't even see that. And so for the Rio Olympics, it's actually running in 5 data centers. We have some data centers in Brazil, in the US, 2 in Europe, and 1 in Asia again, with 10 instances. And by the way, those instances can be spawned through metadata very easily. We can add another instance. In a data center, we can add another instance within about 30 minutes. We can add another data center in about 30 days if we need to. So in real time, we can actually add capacity onto each one of those instances. We take instances up and down. We actually fix instances. We actually add code. We fix bugs in real time and then roll it out across the multiple instances. You have to deal with versioning and make sure you do other things, but it actually works. What is the kind of bug that we deal with? It's actually an interesting specification bug. We get an XML message on every single event which says, these are the people who, you know, this team of people got this time, let's say on the bobsled. The time down the bobsled was 1:32. And in the original message on the 2-man bobsled, you actually expect 2 men on the bobsled. You expect the driver and the coach, 2 men. Turns out, in one of the early stages of the bobsled, they used an alternate because it doesn't. You actually have a team of 3, but only 2 at any time. And so the first time we got a message back, it actually had 3 names in it, but the spec said 2 names. And so we actually, the XML message got pushed out, the saying invalid message. The question is, how quickly can you fix that? Because you understand how the bug happened. It actually was a specification bug. But you also understand that there can be 3 people in a 2-man bobsled team, but only 2 at a time. And so how do you actually fix that? So you take an instance offline, you actually fix it, and then you go from there. You're looking at me. Okay, I'll finish up in a second. But the issue there is actually how do you actually build systems at incredible scale? I'm almost done. Give 2 seconds. Finally is having this thing about a production-first mindset. I'm almost done. Basically, stuff about live site and live measurements. These are things coming back from application insights. Actually start to look for root cause. Even automate communication. In other words, when things go wrong, actually have a bot that actually starts to fill out forms, build databases, inform people. Don't wait for somebody to actually do it. Make the service state visible, not to you, to your users. Be actually very transparent about the system's up, the system's down, the system's slow. We know what's wrong. We have no idea what's wrong. If you tell people, they'll actually love it. And when you discover problems, tell people what you discovered and why. And alerting is actually the key to fast detection. The quicker you can alert people through the telemetry on the engineering and development side, and you can inform your users, turns out you'll actually fix it even quicker. Build a health model. I hope you all know what a health model is for a big application, but build a health model and monitor it. And then finally, always build it with security, because no matter what you do, somebody's going to try and break in. And I'm going to go to this one, which is about feature flags. I talked to this a little bit, which is as you release features and functions, have a feature flag that allows you to switch a feature on and off. Feature availability is not about deploying the code, it's about making it available and making it available to a class of users in different ways at different times. Have an early warning system where you actually can run code in a constrained way so that only certain people see it, but not everybody. And if you want to, you can switch it on for everybody, but you can also switch it off for everybody. And these things all ended up being grouped together in this wonderful. There's a great paper on this that Sam Guggenheimer wrote, which is about the journey from Agile to DevOps. Agile is actually not just about faster delivery. It's actually about changing the way you do it. If you just think you're going to run faster, it's not. It actually is about how you do it and how you actually form this mesh of things together. So, key takeaways at the end. Manage expectations of everybody. Manage your management, manage your team, manage your customers. Be clear and transparent about it. Build a new culture, because this is actually a massive cultural change about people and roles and jobs and where they work and how they work. And then the main trigger for DevOps is actually the transformation of the business. Your business has to be ready to move at speed so that you can move at speed in different ways. And now I'm done.
Thank you.